Good morning. It sounds like we've got Charlie on the line to give us our trails report.
Good morning, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm good.
Beautiful,
I'm good.
Beautiful morning. I can't believe the colors are actually out there. You know, in the end of September, it seemed like they were just not going to happen really much at all. For the last week or 10 days, man, all sorts of things have been going off. It's really kind of cool. I'm just looking up Thames Canyon at the moment, and it's just beautiful. Anyhow, that's so much for that. A couple things. First off, I've gotten a number of requests from folks in the Daly neighborhood that are looking for local trail users who are accessing Daly Canyon to please slow down through the neighborhood a little bit. So it is a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit in there, but it's also a very tight area. There's certainly people and their dogs and so forth and bikers coming and going. So if you're going to be going up to the accessing that trailhead just up in Daly Canyon, just above the neighborhood, please remember to try to slow down a little bit and just be safety conscious. That being said, I also got a bit of information from Rick this morning. A couple things you will notice, this is the most important thing about it, it's just the things going on the trails. Is first off, we are working in Round Valley, getting things ready for winter time. You might see a dump truck or two coming and going. We're adding to road base to some areas that don't groom, groom better at this point for the winter, especially in low snow. So filling in some ruts and so forth over by Matt's Flats and the Barrel Roll area and also, I guess, over by part of Val de Road as well. So this will help hopefully increase some of our grooming terrain out there, especially if we have a lower snow year, which, of course, we hope we don't. Also, if you see, and this is really important because people misunderstand this a lot, if you see flagging on the Treasure Hill area over by Sweeney's, this is really exciting stuff, right? I mean, don't pull those flags. Those are Mountain Trails flags, and we are starting to work on a new trail that will access Mid-Mountain from the bottom of the Sweeney's Lowell Avenue area. So this trail is going to be started really next year, but we are prepping for it now because we do have some of our work up high got finished up, and we just want to get that stuff going. So anyhow, don't mess with our flags, please. It takes a lot for Rick and these guys to get out there and actually mark these potential trail areas. And last but not least, Carolyn, just really want to give a shout out to one group of folks that actually consistently support mountain trails in a big way, and that's all our adopted trail folks, local businesses and so forth that have year after year after year contributed $1,000 per year to support trails in Park City. And you know, without them, and certainly we have, you know, 70-odd adopted trails out there, we wouldn't be able to necessarily do what we do all the time easily. So anyhow, really just want to give those guys a shout-out. Carolyn, I understand you're going to be heading south. I'll get off the radio and let you get going.
We weren't supposed to reveal that. Hey, thanks, Charlie. Who isn't? Who isn't heading south? One last time, right?
Yeah, no one I know. Probably half a town is heading south. So
yeah.
I can't blame them. Actually, I was thinking of going camping up high and just watch the winter storm come in.
Well, there you go. Hey, thanks a lot, Charlie. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Good morning. It's 8:13. Just give you an update on football last night. In a flag-infested and chippy affair, the Park City Miners claimed a share of the Region 10 championship by defeating visiting Tooele 46-27 on Thursday night. Seth Warner and Max Alford scored 3 touchdowns each in the victory. The Wasatch Wasps dropped out of first place in Region 8 following their 21-0 shutout loss to host Salem Hills. Despite outscoring Morgan in the second half, the South Summit Wildcats dropped to .500 on the season after falling 55-13. The Miners and Wildcats, along with the North Summit Braves, wrap up their regular seasons on Wednesday, and the Wasps close out their regular season on Thursday. All games are set for 7 p.m. Well, good morning. It's 8:15, and our first guest on this local news hour is Dr. Wing Province from IHC. He is the medical director there. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm sorry, I got you. I had you on silent there. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great this morning. How are you, Carolyn?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us. So the COVID case counts are on the rise all over the state. Yesterday announced that more than 1,500 people statewide tested positive, and I believe that was put out there as sort of a first that we've hit that number. And of course, you're here to talk about testing and some of the changes that we're undergoing. But it is an interesting thing to see these clustering, spiking numbers going on. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thanks, Carolyn. It is alarming, isn't it? I remember back in the spring, we would be alarmed if we got over 300 or 400. And now here we are at 1,500. I think one reason for alarm is that this is the time of year when it's warm outside that we should be getting our numbers under control and seeing a decrease in our numbers in preparation for the winter months when we can't social distance as well and be outside and enjoying the outdoors. So I think it is a cause for concern, particularly when you see hospitalizations going up.
Are you there?
Can you hear me?
We lost you. You said particularly when hospitalizations are going up.
That's right. That's right. That was the last thing I said.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That was abrupt stop. Yeah. So let's talk about the changes that are happening with the Park City Hospital testing location. Things are moving indoors, or I guess they started this week. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. What we're trying to do is to make our testing more comfortable and more convenient for the community, but also just thinking about our caregivers who are out there administering these tests. I remember in March when we tried to set up this testing site over at the ice arena, and it was actually the day that we had that earthquake. I don't know if you remember that day, Carolyn, but it was freezing outside. And just thinking about the folks who are going to be out there doing this throughout the winter months, we wanted to bring it closer into the indoors, at least so that we can keep our caregivers warm.
Okay, so it's going to get a little more complicated, especially if we're looking at these increase in numbers, which means more contact tracing, more people going in, being asked to be tested. How will it work now? Will the person getting tested only be the one that goes in for the test? How do you anticipate, you know, managing just some of the safety issues for, you know, your staff as well as for the people visiting to get those tests?
Yeah, great question. We plan on, even though our caregivers will have the access to the warm indoors, we're going to try to keep patients and people coming for their tests out in their cars where they're warm and safe as much as possible. So we have it all set up at the Blair Education Center on the other side of the hospital, where we have a drive-through there for folks who are symptomatic. Maybe they have surgery or a procedure coming up and they need to get a pre-procedure test. Or maybe, and we're seeing a lot of this now, maybe your son or daughter or you are exposed and you're coming in to get that screening test, is to make sure that even though you're exposed by someone who is positive, to ensure that you or your loved one doesn't have it. So we're trying to make it as convenient as possible by implementing a couple of new steps in the process. So the key is going to be folks are going to need an order when they come, and there's three ways to get an order. There's a COVID hotline, which is, and I'll just say it now, and we can send you this info, Carolyn, for your listeners to find perhaps on your website. It's 801-844-5224, and we have signs at the drive-through testing site that have these phone numbers available there as well. But you call there, you'll talk to somebody, and they'll generate an order for you based on whether or not you had symptoms or whether or not you were exposed to somebody with COVID-19. Another way is just calling your own doctor or a primary care provider and having them put in an order through their computer system. And lastly, if you call the hotline and it's too long of a wait or you don't have your own primary care provider, you can just come to the testing site. And it will take a little bit longer, but we can get an order in for you that way. So those are the three ways to do it. to get the order. Now, when you arrive, we've also changed things up a bit to make it a little bit more comfortable. I've been tested for COVID several times, particularly when I came back from New York, and it was not the most comfortable experience, as they put that Q-tip in your nostril and tickled the bottom of your brain, at least it felt like to me. That was the nasal swab. Now we have the option of doing a saliva test, where you can come and all you need to do is generate 3 milliliters of saliva that you'll just deposit or spit into a little tube, and then we can send that off for testing. It's a lot more comfortable for the patients and for the folks coming through. There's just a few things to keep in mind. You got to make sure that you're not eating anything for 30 minutes beforehand. Something we've noticed this past week as we've gone to the saliva testing is people are coming, leaving us with their saliva, and then because their coffee or their breakfast was in the saliva, we weren't able to run the test, and so they had to come back, and a few people were upset by that. So just keep in mind, no eating or drinking for 30 minutes beforehand, and that should make it so that all you have to do is come once. We're trying to keep it free for the public, and that's the main thing that we're also trying to do with this new mode, is to make sure that it stays affordable and that people aren't dissuaded from coming to get tested just because they're worried about cost.
Yeah, that's an important issue. In listening into the Park City School District Board of Education meeting, Superintendent Jill Gilday told the board that they should anticipate some changes to quarantine guidelines for students, and that the governor's office and Dr. Angela Dunn are considering dropping the length of time from 14 days to 7 days. What are your thoughts on that? And do you have any insight into how that's happening and why that's happening?
I wish I had more insight into the inner workings and the thoughts behind it, but I can say that we've seen a lot of kids between the ages of 15 to actually more like 10 to 18 who are coming in because they've been quarantined because they were exposed to somebody at school who was COVID positive. The normal incubation period, or in other words, the time it takes for someone to get sick and to really have a lot of virus in their body with this COVID-19 is 14 days. And the thinking behind the quarantine for 14 days is once you're at that 14-day, if you haven't developed any symptoms, then you're safe to go back to school or out in public without spreading that virus to other people. I think now that they're getting so many of these kids who were exposed but not necessarily positive, or they don't know if they were positive for COVID-19, you're getting a lot of kids, my son included, who were having to stay home for 14 days. You know, in my son's case, as with many other children in the Park City School District, having no symptoms at all and wondering, you know, do we need to stay here for the full 14 days? And I think that Jill and the rest of the school district's been getting some pressure to decrease that to less time. And what I'm hearing is 7 days plus a negative test. I think it's an attempt to achieve normalcy for a lot of these families and getting their kids back to school. A lot of folks who are working parents, it's a challenge for them to have their children at home for a full 14 days. So I think that's the why behind it, but I think it's taking that very good reason that the families have and then looking at the science behind it and trying to do what's best to make sure that this virus doesn't spread and get out of control in our own community.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand this really delicate balancing act. Parents have to work. They need school, and the children need school. But with the increases right now going on, also in neighboring Wasatch County, there was a report given to the Wasatch County Council this week from their public health official that they're seeing some concerning rises in cases, and I guess are those two separate issues entirely? The number of cases showing positive compared to the quarantine issue from a science standpoint.
No, I think they're very related. If you have more and more people with COVID-19, there's going to be a greater need to quarantine folks. If these folks are out and about in public, in school, at the grocery store, and and spreading the disease, and there's more of those people, then there's going to be more people who are going to need to quarantine. The idea is by quarantining, you reduce the exposure to other folks, and that's how you get the numbers down. So they're very related issues. And along those lines, I've heard a lot of folks say that they don't want to go get tested because they know they're positive, or they don't want to add to the numbers that are being reported and create a, quote, big deal about this. And it's really, really important that if you have symptoms or you feel like you've been exposed, to go get tested. If we would like to have some semblance of what life was like before this, it's important that we keep these numbers under control and that we're masking and doing the social distancing. If we allow this to get out of control because people are refusing to get tested, particularly those who may be symptomatic and are not quarantining, that's how we're going to lose a lot of the freedoms that we enjoyed in the pre-COVID era. So yeah, it's very important that folks come out. And that's why we're trying to make this testing easy and accessible for everybody.
Yeah. And through the last 6 or 7 months, wasn't the testing effort a combination or a partnership between Intermountain and U of U Healthcare? Is that partnership continuing as you bring it inside, or has that changed?
No, that's a great question. We partnered with the University of Utah at the testing site so that folks, whether regardless of their insurance, could get tested by either one of our institutions. I think it was a great example of collaboration where typically two competitors would be trying to have two different testing sites. We came together and did that. We did, the University of Utah and Intermountain did, I would say maybe put a pause on that collaboration, not because of any competitive reasons, but for the reasons of the weather. There's just the University of Utah folks wanted to take it indoors to Redstone as we took ours indoors to the Park City Hospital. So there's no ill will there. It was a really great experience for both of us. I think we learned a lot from them and at Intermountain, and we hope that they learned from us, and really it was a positive experience, but this is a move based on the weather primarily.
Yeah. Winter coming, I guess.
That's right.
It's the reality. So, all right. Just to finalize the direction on this, you are showing symptoms, or you've come in contact with someone who has tested positive for COVID-19. What should those next steps be?
Yeah, this is a great question. In fact, I've been going to the South Summit schools and some of the Park City schools, and this is probably the most common question I'm getting from the principals and from the teachers is, when should I get tested if I think I've been exposed? So, you know, if someone were to walk in right now, Carolyn, and cough on me while I'm doing this interview, if I were to go get tested, I would not test positive because the virus would not have had enough time to replicate in my body to the point where it could be detectable. So it takes about 5 to 7 days after you've been exposed to someone who's COVID-19 positive for you to have developed enough of the virus for it to be detected. So if someone who has COVID-19 coughs on you, or you've been in contact with them, high-fiving, eating a meal with them, then, you know, 5 to 7 days afterwards. Now, if you're already symptomatic, if you're developing symptoms, then that suggests to us that you already have enough of the virus in your system that it could be detected. And so you would just want to come immediately. You do not need to wait several days after you develop symptoms to come in and get tested.
And so that 5 to 7 days where it takes that time for the virus to settle in, you remain in some kind of isolation or quarantine?
That's a great question, and that's some of the gray area. I think if you've been exposed, that's what the schools have been doing, is saying, yes, you need to quarantine and stay away. And so the same principle you would think would apply for folks at work. If you've been exposed to somebody and you weren't protected from the virus by wearing appropriate personal protective equipment, then yes, you should quarantine and then go and get tested within 5 to 7 days after that exposure.
Yeah, sure. And of course, you have talked with KPCW on several occasions, different programs, about mask wearing and how critical that is to help prevent spreading this virus. I imagine now more than ever, as we get inside more and are in closer contact with people.
Exactly. And I'll just say, with Halloween around the corner, it's kind of crazy to hear myself saying that, but it is coming soon. My fear is that a lot of folks will say, hey, I'm outside, I don't need to wear a mask. I don't know if we're going to be trick-or-treating. That's up to our very competent and public health officials, who I trust implicitly. But if we do proceed forward with trick-or-treating, it's important to be creative and incorporate those masks into your costumes. Just because you're outside, it doesn't mean that you're in a COVID-free environment. We know that this disease is spread through droplets, primarily from people talking, sneezing, coughing, and those sorts of activities. So just because you're outside doesn't mean you're completely safe. It's important to get creative and incorporate those masks in our Halloween festivities. And especially, you know, this year, I would say try to avoid any of those indoor parties, Halloween parties, particularly our high school and college age students. I remember my college years, and I had some really fun, really great Halloween parties. There was usually a lot of people inside. And I would just ask those folks who are considering having Halloween parties this year to maybe hold off on that until for another year, because those are super spreader events where folks are all inside and not able to social distance and spreading it. And what we're seeing is, you know, it's the 15 to 24 year olds who are really surging with COVID-19 cases, particularly over the last month. And now, sadly, what we're seeing is the ages greater than that. So those in the 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, and 60-year-olds are now starting to surge and go up because they got it from their college-age kids or grandkids. And along with that, now we're starting to see an increase in hospitalizations. And that's really the primary concern with younger folks getting it, is spreading it to the older folks.
Yeah.
So that could potentially happen in Halloween. So please, please, sure, if you can at all costs, try to avoid those indoor parties.
Yeah. Okay. And then just finally, just to clarify, the COVID test, if you need it, is free at the IHC facility.
That's right. At Park City Hospital, we are not charging patients for coming to get it.
Okay.
We want to make sure that we get this under control.
Okay. Well, thank you, Wing. I appreciate you coming on this morning. That's Dr. Wing Province. He's the medical director with the Park City Hospital. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Okay, bye now. We've got next up on the line Park City Council member Max Doylny here to talk about the town of Hideout, which is located in Wasatch County. And of course, as we've reported all through the summer months, their interests in annexing a parcel of land that is located in Summit County near Richardson Flat. Good morning, Max. Thank you for coming on.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let me just kind of give a little preamble here. House Bill 359 was passed by the Utah legislature in March, and it allowed for cross-county annexation without the county's consent. And the town of Hideout, again, located in Wasatch County, used this legislation to begin the annexation process of Richardson Flat areas on July 9th. And the town says it needs to provide services for the growing Jordanelle area, which is projected to have some potentially 20,000 homes built in those particular areas. And town also says they are in desperate need of taxable commercial services. So can you talk a little bit about just how that would happen? How would a town be established without having a plan for services like what they're looking to do with a Hideout annexation?
Well, I think you raise a really good point there, Carolyn. Normally, annexations happen when an extension of a community is in need of services. So people live outside of the city limits or something like that, and then the city annexes them in to provide that that population with, you know, a school system, fire, safety, et cetera, transit, recreation, you name it. In this case, they're kind of doing it backwards, right? They're going to vacant land and trying to build a city on that vacant land so that they can provide themselves with services. But they have not had any discussions that we know of with the school district, They've had no discussions with the Summit County Sheriff or Park City Police Department, no discussions with Park City Fire District, no discussions have taken place with Park City Transit District or Summit County. No discussions have taken place with either the Park City Recreation Department or Summit County Basin Recreation or Public Works, so, or water for that matter. So they frankly have zero idea of how they're going to provide all of the things that they need to provide to a community that they don't know how they want to build it. They had a conflict the other night. Well, maybe not a conflict, but maybe their commission met, their planning commission met the other night, and their recommendations were diametrically different from those proposed by the developer. And Park City's been pushing back on this all summer, and we continue to do so. We're calling it the summer spoiler.
Yeah, well, Park City and Summit County have been very vocal in their opposition to this, and Summit County has entered into some legal wranglings, of course, and we try to follow that as closely as possible. Do you expect that Park City would also move into the direction of litigating this?
You know, I don't want to speak too much to our to the legal ramifications of this, but we do have a development agreement on a portion of Richardson Flats. The current annexation that Hideout is trying to do, we do not have a development agreement on. Park City does not, but we are a party to part of a lawsuit that's happening between Summit County and the developer. But we're still opposing the annexation of the 350 acres that Nate Brockbank and Josh Romney are trying to push through the town of Hideout, because we just don't feel like they are prepared to provide the services that they think they're prepared to provide. There's already a million square feet of commercial development nodes around the Jordanelle Parkway and around the Jordanelle Reservoir. These owners of these pieces of property haven't been encouraged or pushed to develop that commercial, but there are many nodes of commercial real estate ready to be developed. It just comes down to the developers actually pulling the trigger and doing it.
And those nodes that are in place that have already been allotted around the Jordanelle, why would the developers not just approach that opportunity?
That's a good question, Carolyn. I think that there's a little bit more in it for the developer to get this annexation done through the town of Hideout. They seem to be the only voice in the room at every council meeting and planning commission meeting that we've been listening to. They've been an integral member of the vocal input that happens at those meetings, where there has been no public input, none. And there is public input welcomed on Monday at 6 o'clock. So October 12th, they're having their first meeting since the beginning of July, where they're taking public input on this process. At their last meeting, they were circling around how to limit the voices, or at least drown out the voices from the region, in favor of people from the town of Hideout and closer to where they're trying to annex. I found it kind of interesting that they're afraid to hear from the region when they've been saying all along that they want regional collaboration and they want to solve the problems of the region. But now they're trying to figure out how to drown out the voices of those of us who are going to be affected on their public meeting. So they're scrambling, but I still encourage everybody to get out there and speak their mind.
So is the meeting virtual? I presume it will be. And
it is. Yeah. Okay. And you can send in letters. You can send in a letter and have it and request that it be made part of the record. That will help. But, quite frankly, Carolyn, I think that they know exactly what they're going to hear from pretty much everybody in the region, which is you're acting too fast. It's an irresponsible annexation. Just because it's legal for a period of time doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. Two judges and the state legislature have said that this was this law came into effect in the wrong way, and they repealed the law. Now, there's a window of time where it remains law. That happens a lot of time in the legislative process. And that period of that window is closing quickly. It closes on the 19th of October. So they're trying to rush through an annexation process, you know, that usually would take years. These things are very complicated and very difficult. Lots of questions to be answered. They don't even know the right questions to ask at this point. So we're saying you should hold off, pause, do this the right way. If they pass this law through the legislature in a future session, and it goes through the right way with the right amount of public input, then move forward. But the way that this is going is, it looks a little crooked by pretty much every metric.
And we've got until, well, October 19th, which is Thursday, right? And what happens if the annexation attempt goes through? Will that continue into, you know, the courts and be disputed there, or is it a done deal?
Well, that's a good question, Carolyn. I am not a lawyer, and I do not know the full answer to that. But the standard is, if they are, if they've done a legal annexation in the window of time when this law exists, then they will have the right to that property. And so, and then, you know, we'll have to fight the legal battle with Summit County or watch how that plays out to see what they're able to do with that land. But I can't imagine that that fight's ending anytime soon.
Yeah. You've also mentioned in the past, in conversations with KPCW, that Hideout is close to the food town in Camas, in the town of Camas, and that the drive time to Camas is relatively similar to how long it takes to drive to Richardson Flat. So Hideout has a, you know, pretty well-documented financial history and will need taxable revenue sources in order to provide essential services. Isn't the Hideout Town Council obligated to act in the best interests of their residents?
Sure, yeah. I understand that they have some big problems out there that they're trying to solve. And I can understand where they're coming from. I just think that they should go about it the right way. The mayor and I, along with our city manager and some staff, went out and had a meeting with them, and we thought it was a pretty productive meeting. We've welcomed them to be part of our regional conversations and to communicate about what kind of problems they have and how we can help them solve those problems. But it's really hard to start a relationship this way. And they've felt like they've been ignored by Wasatch County, and their residents feel like they're a part of Park City. Now, you know, we're open to having conversations about how to make that functionally work, but forcing your way into a seat at the table is not necessarily the way to go about it, in our opinion. So I do feel for them. I know they're trying to do what's in the best interest of their community, but we're actually acting in the best interest of the greater region, right? It's not just about their one little community. And everybody in the region, from Wasatch County, Summit County, Park City, even their neighbors between where they are and the annexation property, have said, please stop this. And they're not listening to anybody. So that's not a very good regional partner by my calculations.
Right. Okay. So Monday is the meeting, and I presume the Hideout has a virtual link that is available to Hideout Town. Starts at 6:00, and you're encouraging people to sign up and listen in and give input.
Absolutely. Please participate. This is our only opportunity for the public to speak their mind. I encourage the people of the town of Hideout to come out and speak their mind as well. Do they agree with what's happening with their town council? Because that's who Hideout really wants to hear from, because they know that they're going to get a bunch of dissent from the region. So if you're in the town of Hideout, speak up, especially if you think that they're not doing this the right way, because it will have ramifications going forward. The meeting's at 6:00 Monday evening. Please tune in. You can get the link at the Hideout Town Council's website.
Okay. Thank you very much, Max. That's Max Doylny, Park City Council member. Thanks for giving us
Thanks, Sarah.
Bye now. Next up on the line, I have Sunrise Rotary member, Park City Sunrise Rotary member, Jim Whitney, with a message that basically when life gives you lemons, take your best shot with the Shotski event, home edition. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's pretty soft. Okay, there we go.
All right.
We're having a little problem on our switchboard. So, yeah, like so many fun events, of course, through the year, through this time of COVID, the communal shot ski has to also be postponed. But it sounds like you've got an alternative plan in place and that you're still planning to bring this back in the springtime.
Yeah, you know, 2020 being what it is, everything's kind of been thrown up in the air. And so we did decide that there was just no way to do an in-person with, you know, 1,400 people live on Main Street shoulder to shoulder. So we are currently hosting the 2020 Shotski home edition. And then, yes, our plan is to have the live in-person event again in May and go for the actual world record at that time.
Okay, the world record, what would that be?
So the world record will be at that time, the last round we got beat again by Breckenridge. We kind of trade back and forth, and so I think we're probably at right about 1,400 people will be the world record.
Okay, 1,400 people. So do you start now trying to, you know, basically solicit those folks to come join, or is that not the issue?
No, that's not the issue. What we realized is normally we would have done it right now in October, and just so sad to let that pass and so sad not to bring the community event to the community. So we decided to do this at-home edition just to kind of give everybody a little boost and have some fun, and you can do it at home. And the idea this year, right now in October, is on the 24th, you get your package, and then on the 24th, we can all kind of do a shot. We're not going to pick a time. We're not trying to break the record. We just want to kind of get some community involvement and bring everybody together. And you can post pictures of you and your party doing your group doing your shot and tag it Park City Shotski or PC Shotski 2020. And then we can all kind of see each other's posts and have the fun of that distanced interaction.
Okay. So then how are you getting people to, you know, donate and create the actual fundraising event?
So if you go to parkcityshotski.com, that will bring you to an Eventbrite page where you can choose a general admission. We were calling it general admission just for lack of a better term, a $25 kit, which will get you two custom shot glasses, a mason jar with the High West lemonade mix, the simple syrup for the High West lemonade for your after shot party cocktails. And you'll get two shots from our participating member, the Big Shots company that makes the little rubber mounts that mount to your ski. And then you can mount, and you'll get two or three fresh lemons. And so you can do your shot, and then you can have some High West whiskey lemonade after. Then we also have the VIP package, which is a $200 ticket. And that comes with three shot glasses, three mounts, the fresh lemons again, the High West lemonade syrup again, a High West beanie that is the Apres team High West beanie, and you actually then get your own custom wrapped 2020 when life gives you lemons, take your best shot ski. So you actually get a ski custom wrapped that you can put your shot glasses on, and that's the $200 package. And then you'll be able to pick these up locally. And then through today, we're picking up at High West at the Nielsen Cottage. After that, High West has some things there just getting kind of busy. So pickup starting on Monday will be at the Hugo Coffee Shop at the Visitor Center at Kimball Junction.
Okay. And there are some contests that are going on with the virtual event?
So what we're just to kind of add to the fun, we're, if, when you post your post on the 24th and you can tag it, hashtag PC Home Shot Ski in the caption, and then the folks at High West, our generous, wonderful sponsor, we'll pick a winner of the posts, the photos, and you'll get dinner for two at the Nelson Cottage, $100 value. You'll get the winner of that will get a 2020 limited edition wrapped shot ski, the ski itself, a High West burlap bag, a High West flask, a High West hat, and two sipping glasses. High West wants to point out that they're not really a shot whiskey. They consider themselves to be a sipping whiskey, but in this case, we're all taking our best shot at 2020 because it's been kind of a lemon.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it sounds like you're making some good lemonade out of this.
Yes,
all right. So just for clarification, then it looks like we've got pickups today at High West, and then that changes to Hugo Coffee next week, and the
Correct.
Virtual event happens October 24th. So we'll have to make sure we get all of those details on our website to help inform people about how they can
right.
participate. All right.
ParkCityShotSki.com.
Sure. Okay. Thank
Pretty
you.
Easy. Thanks so much, everybody. Go out and give it your best shot.
Yeah. Okay. That's Jim Whitney with the Park City Sunrise Rotary. Thanks for joining us. Bye now.
Thank you.
Good morning. We're wrapping up our local news hour. One more story, though. With a public hearing on Hideout Town's proposed annexation into Summit County coming up soon on October 12th, as we just discussed with Max Dornley, the town council held a work session on Tuesday. They discussed some concepts recommended by their planning commission. Among those, the planning panel is advising no big box commercial in the proposed town center. And Rick Bruff reports they called for a decrease in the residential density.
Nate Brockbank is planning a mixed-use development on the 348 acres that Hideout is contemplating for annexation. The plan includes a town center bisected by Richardson Flat Road and two other village centers located to the south. The Hideout Planning Commission, after meeting October 5th, came up with a set of conditions and recommendations. They said the planned residential is too dense for the site, noting the extent of vegetation removal, the lack of space between buildings, the need for retaining walls, and traffic impacts. They suggested cutting back on single-family, townhomes, condos, and affordable multifamily, but did propose adding cottages, including some that would be deed-restricted. Overall, the total number of residential units would be cut back from 836 to 400. Planning Commission Vice Chairman Ralph Severini talked about what they're trying to achieve with the density changes.
And essentially just wanted to reduce the density, you know, maybe encourage the size of the lots and, you know, further balance out the approach to condos, townhouses, single-family homes, with achieving a greater balance with single-family.
He said they want to add some affordable cottages to the mix.
This is kind of, you know, smaller homes that are either purchasable by a, you know, maybe a young professional, perhaps. I'm not going to characterize this exactly, but a new professional coming into Park City to work, where right now they're priced out of the Park City market. And then the deed-restrictable cottages would be kind of a small group of homes that would be affordable for perhaps even a young couple with a child, so to speak, to get started.
Developer Brock Bank said he liked the cottage idea, but this was the first time he had heard about the density decreases, and those, he said, are tough. The Planning Commission proposed, for instance, implementing twin home structures rather than four or six plats townhomes. The developer said with the density he's proposing, they already have nearly 60% open space. His planner, Eric Landvart, said they have a number of expensive amenities and infrastructure in the project.
I was sitting there and hearing a lot of the wishes and then balancing that with that size of a density reduction, you know, I can tell you it's not going to pencil. You know, the definition of a town center, you know, is a more dense core. So I think if we can separate a couple of the issues, you know, between, you know, not having four and sixplex townhomes versus, you know, not having density that can help support a town center and the amenities that come with not only the town center, but, you know, the rest of the project, you know, those two roads that do head out to 248 have no development on them. Currently, those are expensive, you know, underpasses, the ski lift, et cetera, you know, really gets to be a pricey endeavor. And everybody thinks that developers just print money, but I can tell you that it's the margins are slimmer than you can imagine.
Broadbank suggests.
That is Hideout planner Eric Langvart. And finally, Hideout council member Chris Baer noted the plan has a 5-acre school site. She said the site is within the boundaries of the Park City School District, though they haven't talked to the district at this point. Thank you for listening to KPCW this morning.